Smart person to the right.
We're probably one or two votes short of a quorum, but we'll start out as a subcommittee. And first bill under consideration will be Senate File 962, Senator Prentner Solon, Duluth Aircraft Facilities, State Financing Modifications. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this will be a very brief bill. It was, I don't know where it was heard before. I know it's had a hearing before.
Local government?
I guess it was state and local government operations. So it is the second hearing. And this is a bill that will help pave the way to finding a new tenant for the aircraft maintenance facility that's up in Duluth at such time as Northwest Airlines formally rejects the building lease. When the state and local governments put up the money to develop the aircraft maintenance facility, there were certain conditions placed on the lease by a specific provision in state law. This legislation would remove some of those statutory provisions so that we have greater flexibility in finding a prospective new tenant for the building. The specific language of this bill was developed by the Department of Finance, and that's why I have Mr. Sausen with me. And I would like him to describe the bill to you. I know that St. Louis County and the City of Duluth have both indicated support for the measure also, and I have the Mayor of Duluth, Mayor Herb Bergson, with us also to respond to any questions you might have. So I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Sausen at this time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Peter Sausen from the Department of Finance. In 1991, the legislature passed enabling legislation that allowed the state to enter into agreements with Northwest Airlines and to sell state bonds to finance the maintenance facility at the Duluth Airport. Those agreements were entered into. The bonds were sold in 1995, and the maintenance facility was built with a lease between Northwest Airlines and the Duluth Economic Development Authority. Northwest had to meet certain public policy covenants, including employment at the Duluth facility, which they met until 2004. When the mechanics went on strike in August of 2005, Northwest shut the facility down. It has been shut down since then, and the lease that between Duluth Economic Development Authority and Northwest is part of the bankruptcy process. In the bankruptcy process, Northwest will have to either affirm or reject the lease. We expect that they'll reject the lease, and at that time, the facility will be available to lease to another party. Another party will most likely will not be another airline company, maybe just an operator who does the maintenance on airplanes. There are provisions in the bill that you have before you today that amend the original enabling legislation. In a couple places, adds the word lease to make it clear that the building can be leased, takes out a provision related to the Metropolitan Airports Commission owning the facility, which won't be done, takes out provisions related to an engine repair facility, which was never done, and it takes out public policy covenants that were put in place to require Northwest Airlines to meet certain requirements. It is unlikely that the new tenant would be an airline company, and to require them to have their headquarters here would probably be a problem. To require them to have information related to flights. If they have no flights, they couldn't do it. So those sections come out just to make sure that the facility can be leased to another party.
Okay, Mayor, did you wish to comment?
Chairman and Senators, just briefly, the City of Duluth supports this change. If and when the lease is rejected, we are the ones with the smallest pockets on the hook. We can't afford to be paying the freight on this building, and the sooner the building is marketable, the easier it's going to be for us to get off that hook. It's not going to be easy to find a company to accept a lease there just because it's going to be an expensive lease. And we need to do everything in our power to make it marketable, and these changes would certainly do that. I do have the support of my city council on this and the local business community as well.
Okay, we do have a quorum. Any questions of the witnesses or the senator on this? I guess the airlines is in bankruptcy, so we're finding another possible use, I would guess, for the building or buildings. Is it one building, one big building? Up in Duluth.
One big building.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is an option for the finance in the city and So we'll, Senator Day, did you?
I'd so move.
And apparently now you get another stop, the Finance Committee, I think, wants to hear it too. Did I hear that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of that. I don't. I didn't see any request for the bill, but if it needs to go to Finance, I'm not sure
why. We have it on
our.
Does anybody know? Did they? Brian?
Did they? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to wherever you'd like
okay,
it to
yeah,
go.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sausen is indicating to me that they do want it in Finance.
Okay. On the day motion to recommend the bill to pass and forward it to the Finance Committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, and good luck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next bill we're going to look at this afternoon will be Senate File 1666. Senator Clark, Bioscience Business Promotion Marketing Program and Deed. Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do believe this is an amendment. I don't know for sure if you want to do this now or not. But just to give you the broad context of the bill, this relates to biosciences, particularly in greater Minnesota. We have a great opportunity right now moving forward in our state to be real leaders. And one of the areas that I know I get personally excited about is the opportunities, not just in the medical, biomedical area, but within applied sciences as well. And we're seeing that all over the state, particularly in areas that have a Minsku institution nearby them. And what our hope to do with this bill is to make sure as our state is out there talking about promoting and encouraging to attract good jobs, good businesses that might be interested in this, that we make sure Greater Minnesota is a part of that. What the amendment does, Mr. Chair, is it reduced what the request is in the bill.
Why don't we Senator Sparks will move the amendment A1 to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it in. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Did that cut your request down, did it?
Yes, it did.
Oh. You sure you want to do that?
Just trying to make sure, you know, I know money's a little
tight money
around
here.
We're trying to make everything fit. And, Mr. Chair, I have Tom Moore, who's head of our Economic Development Partnership in the St. Cloud area, to speak to this bill.
Mr. Moore, welcome to the Minnesota Senate.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Moore, and I'm president of the St. Cloud Area Economic Development Partnership. We're a regional public-private nonprofit organization serving the greater St. Cloud area and central Minnesota. Our 24 members and 17 associate members include Stearns, Benton, and Sherburne counties, along with the cities of St. Cloud, Sartell, Sauk Rapids, Waite Park, St. Joseph, and Becker, along with all of the area utilities, colleges and universities, the healthcare systems, the Chamber of Commerce, the Initiative Foundation, plus many area financial institutions, commercial builders and organizations that have an interest in the economic development of the region. The partnership's mission is to generate high-quality jobs and increase the tax base by promoting and facilitating the growth of existing businesses and the development of new businesses. We have a very aggressive business retention expansion program through which our teams of community leaders regularly meet with the CEOs, plant managers, and owners of over 100 of the region's largest employers each year. We identify major issues of concern and put them in touch with a variety of local, regional, and statewide resources in an effort to help them remain in business and expand here in Minnesota. From a bioscience perspective, perhaps you saw in the lower level of the building the bioscience fair here today. That's part of an effort on behalf of the Department of Employment and Economic Development and Positively Minnesota to help us think more strategically. We can't rely on what we already have in the bioscience area. We need to help grow that industry. In order to do that, we need to work together. We don't want to pit community against community within the state, and we don't really have a corner on the bioscience market. We need to continue to work well together. Minnesota has a great story to tell, and our view is that not many people are telling that great story. This would allow some dollars to the department to promote the area, emphasizing outstate Minnesota, and the skills that are required to meet the needs in the workforce area for medical devices, that training is transferable. The University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic, where the bioscience zones are currently located, will have companies, will assist companies in the process. We want to keep bio and science-based manufacturing jobs here in Minnesota. This bill emphasizes greater Minnesota, and it connects bioscience and science-based companies to higher education throughout the state. So we would encourage you to support this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions of the committee? Well, I believe finance wants to see this one also, of course, with the money. So Senator Neville, he moves that Senate File 1166 be recommended to pass and forward it to the Finance Committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Work.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson or Marty? Senator Tomsoni, did you want to sit for a minute and before you're... Okay, apparently I think Senator Anderson is on her way. I think I've got a deed housekeeping policy bill that I think is pretty, hopefully pretty easy. So without objection, we'll try to do this one in a hurry.
We will now be hearing Senate File Number 975 from Senator Metzen. It is a bill related to technical changes from deed.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that Senate File 975, the deed housekeeping bill and policy bill, is not controversial. Changes the contamination cleanup grant program a little bit. It restores the redevelopment grant program to its original form, designating Minnesota's trade office as the state's office of protocol. I believe that's a name change only. And changing the definition of support employment adds a new category to the extended deployment program. Some changes to the Rehabilitation Board, and it eliminates a report. I have there's an amendment at the desk. if you could help me with the number on that.
That in just a second here. It's the A2 amendment, and we'll pass that out.
Okay.
And if you'd like to start with
yeah,
that,
it adds
Senator
a criteria to the redevelopment account that allows deed to grant funds from the program to an expansion of...
Excuse me, it is the A1 amendment.
A1. Bioscience business in Minnesota. I think they combined it, and also adds language to the urban initiative program, which is also administered by deed. So a deed is okay with the amendments. Maybe I could have the department add just a little more to the housekeeping bill that I stated.
Very good. If we just want everyone to take a look at the A1 amendment, and Senator Metzen moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment passes. Good time.
That's a big report.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
And just introduce yourself for the tape, please. Thank you.
My name is Meredith Udoybach, and I'm the director of the Brownfields and Community Assistance Unit at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I have the first few sections of the housekeeping bill that I will tell you what they do. The first section of the bill deals with our contamination cleanup grant program. We have three sources of funding for that program. Two of those sources of funding are available only for 4 years. This gets to be somewhat problematic for us because the money is appropriated at the beginning of the biennium. We award grants every 6 months. So by the last cycle in the second year of the biennium, those 4 years really become 2 years. Cleaning up contaminated sites often takes a little bit longer than normal economic development projects because of the fact that there's contamination on those sites, which is very expensive to clean up. A lot of times the projects aren't quite as cooked as other economic development projects are because of that factor, and they take a little bit longer to complete. So we don't want to lose any of our funds for a program that has been doubly oversubscribed since it began, and so we're asking to have those funds available until spent so that we can make sure we don't lose any of those funds. The second section of the bill also has to do with our contamination cleanup grant program. We have a qualifying criteria in that statute that says in order to be eligible for grant funds, you have to have a very high cleanup cost and a low land value. We think that's a prudent thing to look at in awarding government funds to make sure that sites we give cleanup dollars to are ones that actually need government money to induce the private sector to develop on them. But we think that that provision is simply misplaced in our statute, and we'd like to put it in the priority section of our statute as something that we look at when we assess who's going to get our grants rather than having it be a qualifying criteria. This would also line up with some of the other funding partners that we have, the Met Council, Hennepin County, Ramsey County. They also look at such a valuation piece, but they have it in their priority section as opposed to their qualifying criteria section. So we're just asking to move that criteria within our statute. Sections 4 and 5 have to do with our redevelopment grant program. And I believe that you have a handout that has some has a map on it and some pie charts that did everyone get?
Not sure we have those.
I didn't see the.
I think the department had sent that up yesterday.
We have one that we can pass around.
The one in my file? I know. Well, I guess I get it.
You know what? I do. Excuse me.
We do have copies, and they're on their way.
Okay,
thank
otherwise
you.
I
please
have
continue
some additional
with
copies.
Way.
I'll give you a little background on this program and tell you what we're trying to do in these two sections. This program was created in 1998, and it was a statewide program at that time. It had general fund money also at that time. And during the Ventura administration, the program we had was switched to a Greater Minnesota-only program with the thought that the Met Council would be doing redevelopment in the metro area. They never had a program that was established in statute, and what resulted was the redevelopment program being a Greater Minnesota-only program with no redevelopment program for the metro area to tap into. Currently, the program's been changed back to the status of us only being able to look at assisting redevelopment needs in the metro area if we don't have enough applications come in from Greater Minnesota. What we are proposing to do in Sections 4 and 5 is bring the program back into the exact same statute that it was originally run from 1998 to 2001. And the handout that you have shows the distribution of the sites that we were able to fund under that statute, which guarantees 25% of the funds to go to Greater Minnesota and the remainder of the funds to be competitive between Greater Minnesota and the metro area. You can see from the map that we were able to fund sites all over the state. The pie charts will show you that the applications that came in were awarded out pretty much at the same rate, and the dollar requests that came in from the various areas of the state also went out pretty much at the same rate under that scenario. It worked really well, which is why we're proposing to bring it back to the statewide jurisdiction with 25% of the funds guaranteed to Greater Minnesota. We're also able to accomplish projects all over the state under that scenario because projects in the metro are a little bit more expensive than they are in Greater Minnesota. So while there's a guarantee of 25% to Greater Minnesota, we're certainly able to do projects throughout the entire state.
I'm sorry, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you show us where that is? That language is exactly in the bill changing the...
And Ms. Undeboy.
I thought you said it was Section 4 or 5. I'm
it's
just
Section
a hard time.
4 and 5. So in line 3.16 where it takes out if the commissioner determines that the applications are less by taking that out, and then in Section 5... Under the priority section of our statute, we add a few sentences in the back, and that's where you see the spell out of the 25% guaranteed to go to Greater Minnesota, with the rest then being up for grabs for the whole state.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, of course, I'm going to hear, Senator Sparks and I are sitting here trying to protect our Greater Minnesota. And along with everybody else, but how are these grants advertised for Greater Minnesota? How do communities, projects know that there is this redevelopment grant available? Because I'm just kind of surprised that we have to go back to only 25% being awarded to Greater Minnesota, and then.
And Ms. Hudebach.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we have grant cycles that we run, or workshops that we do throughout the state before each of our grant cycles every 6 months, and we're involved in Economic Development Association of Minnesota and NAR. Also, I think most of the economic developers in the cities throughout the state are familiar with the redevelopment program, and we certainly try to make ourselves available and get out there as much as we can to do marketing of the program.
Madam Chair. Yes. Ms. Udoybach. How do you say
your Rosen?
Udoybach.
Udoybach. What happens if a community doesn't have an economic development
Ms. Hudebach,
an EDA director.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we send notices statewide to every city clerk. So if there isn't, when we do workshops, so that we make sure that every city is notified, and hopefully if there is an economic development director, the city clerk or the mayor who gets the letter would be able to trickle that information down to folks that might want to attend the workshops. We're certainly available. We help folks put applications together if they need assistance with that. So forth. We realize that some of the, especially Greater Minnesota communities, are smaller and don't have the resources that some of the larger ones do, and accommodate them if we can.
Senator Rosen,
thank you. So there is help for these communities to write the grants, and they are getting sufficient information about the availability of these grants. That they know this is out there. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I would hope so. We can't help them write the grants because that would be a conflict of interest to then review the grants, but we would certainly put them in touch with folks that we know that could give them some assistance. Quite honestly, we've never had anyone tell us that they can't write a grant application, and we've hopefully made it very easy for people to write that application. It's not a real lengthy or difficult application that we've put together, but if we ever had that request, we would certainly try to put them in touch with someone that would be able to help them, and we do our best to make aware of the programs that we have available.
Okay, thank you.
And a question from Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and probably to Ms. Hubeck. You mentioned that the Met Council was supposed to do the redevelopment in the Minneapolis or the metropolitan area after 2001. What happened so that didn't occur and that you have to go back to this language?
And Ms. Hudebach.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, it's my understanding that during that time there was thought that there would be statute language written that would create a redevelopment program under the Met Council jurisdiction within the Livable Communities Act, and that never happened. There were a lot of things that got vetoed that particular session, and that was a statute that was supposed to get written and just never did.
So, Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Hubeck, why are we not considering that as an alternative, as opposed to doing this change? And I wasn't part of this in 2001, but I'll just take a little stab at 2001. There was significant, relief of property taxes to this area from the transit takeover then, and I would bet that they were thinking part of that would go to doing this livable communities thing. Now that didn't happen, so we're going to go back and revisit the split between the greater Minnesota and the Minneapolis-St. Paul, and I'm not sure that I would be supportive of this.
Well, Madam Chair, if
Senator Metzen.
If we could carve out the general fund money that's derived from the cities and split it that way, it'd be but the whole state is paid today. Mm-hmm. We just got to go back to the way the formula was set up to do it. And the monies are collected from all of us. All of us meaning the seven county area, and we're not receiving any.
And Madam Chair,
now you would still get an advantage in this situation because you'd be guaranteed the 25, and everybody would go to bat and fight for the remaining 75. So you could probably end up with 75-80%. I don't know what percentage, but the monies are collected from the whole state.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, what was the rationale for undoing this, and why was the Met Council supposed to be picking this up with the livable communities grants?
I was around, quite frankly, during the Ventura administration, and I don't know why the administration recommended this and why it was done. So, but it certainly is an issue of fairness. Quite frankly, in the old days, everybody would go out for the 100% and go in and fight for it and have wonderful proposals. So you don't know which way would go back then, but at least it was an equal footing. So we're trying to massage it a little bit. As long as all of us are paid for it, give you the first 25% of the bite of the apple, and then 75% is like the old days where it was 100.
Compared,
if that makes sense.
Madam Chair, Senator Metz. So the first 25% is rural competitive grants just for rural communities. The rest of the 75% is competitive grant for all communities.
That is correct.
So it's a guarantee for greater Minnesota,
yes,
essentially.
It's
and everything else is then competitive.
25%, and I don't know what it would end up at the end of the day. It could be 75, 80. I don't know. But it could be.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, I can take a guess at what it'll be by the pie charts that were revealed here. The dollars requested for Minneapolis-St. Paul were 34%, and the dollars awarded were 52%, 1998 to 2001. So,
Madam Chair.
And Senator Rosen.
It appears to me, Senator Skoy, I think greater Minnesota has to have greater requests, more expensive requests. That this truly is a disparity issue.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Skoy and Senator Rosen, if I may kind of qualify that. The reason why those percentages appear to be larger, if you look at the other pie chart that shows where the application or where the needs are and where they went out, those show a pretty equal distribution. The projects in the metro area tend to be more expensive because the projects that we see come in from greater Minnesota are smaller. Greater Minnesota doesn't have as many large old grain elevators that you see off of 280 like they have in the metro area. So the reason why the dollar amounts or the percentage is higher is because the metro projects tend to be much larger. We have much larger old abandoned industrial facilities or stockyards in the metro area than we do in greater Minnesota. So the needs are met on an equal distribution of what they come in, but you'll see that the dollar amounts are higher for the metro area because of that reason.
Other questions on this particular area? Okay, would you like to proceed with some of the other sections? Ms. Udebeck.
Madam Chair, for the committee's records, I'm John Sherman with Rehabilitation Services in the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Sherman.
Thank you. Section 6 actually is an interesting section for someone from Rehab Services to do, but we didn't want to bring a third person up here. And this is the section that would designate the department as the official Office of Protocol for the state of Minnesota. And an Office of Protocol works with visiting, usually elected officials or dignitaries who are visiting the governor or the lieutenant governor's office. Currently, that function is actually handled by the trade office in the department. This would put an official title on it and give, say, a foreign country or an embassy that is expecting to send a visitor to Minnesota a place to work with immediately. And so it puts a title on us to a function that we're already doing. Sections 7, 8, 9, and 10 deal with the extended employment program and rehabilitation services, which provides ongoing support services for individuals with severe disabilities. These sections are technical changes to, well, section 7 is a technical change to the supported employment definition section, and it goes in conjunction with section 10, which allows us to operationalize a test. And essentially what it does is it allows us to consider as a supported employment site, which is a more favorable type of employment, some individual programs that are community rehabilitation programs. And this was brought forward to the department's attention because one of our programs was, in effect, in our perspective, being unfairly penalized by our own state statute. And without changing the statute, we could not do anything about it. Section 6 changes the definition. The reviser says that you cannot do policy in a definitional section change, so he added Section 10, which allows us as a department to test a particular site to see if it's integrated. Section 7 creates affirmative business enterprise, which is a new form of economic development model of employment that we've, in fact, been studying for 2 years. There is a specific program.
I think you're talking about Section 8.
Section 8,
Thank you. Thank you. Just wanted to clarify that.
Section 7 is definition. Section 8 is also definition, but it covers a new type of employment. Currently, there is one model. It's custom products operated by the Occupational Developmental Center in Thief River Falls. It is unique in the nation. It is the first program certified as such in the nation. And we wanted to be able to include them at the appropriate level in our funding system and to encourage other types of employment like it. Section 9 is a section that essentially eliminates relatively outmoded language that we require of our community rehab program's board of directors in terms of its composition. This language has been in statute since, frankly, the late 1960s, late 1950s in some place. We looked at it as part of our cleanup and said there's no reason that we should be mandating this type of composition. These programs have definitely grown up and are quite sophisticated and can do it very well without state interference. Section 10, of course, is the section that operationalizes Section 7, and Section 11 is a repealer that repeals essentially a report that we did back in the 80s. The function was that we did it. It was a procurement report. That function was transferred to the Department of Information Administration. We currently prepare the report that has no useful information and send it to you. While we believe in job development in our department, this is probably not an appropriate job, and we would just like to take it off the books.
Okay.
I'll stand for questions on those
Thank
items.
You. And other questions on any of the sections that were just described?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
I do have a question on the Section 8, the Affirmative Business Enterprise Employment Program. Can you just explain a little bit more about that?
And Mr. Sherman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. Yes. Many of our programs are what we call center-based employment. That is, employment that's on the site of a rehabilitation facility. And, for example, ABC in Rochester, Opportunity Partners, ODC in the north. These programs have as a component the use of subminimum wage. That is, they're by federal law, they are allowed to pay individuals based on productivity below minimum wage. This model takes an economic development model and essentially says We are a business. This business will treat every individual with a disability or without a disability the same way, which means wages are the same, integration is the same, benefits are provided. It takes some reengineering. It is the one example that we've had in Thief River has produced results that are competitive and favorable with much of the rest of the state, particularly with center-based employment. And at this point, we have exactly one example. We are putting it in statute to see how it works out in the rest of the state. My thought probably will be that in 2 or 3 years we'll be evaluating the whole process and see what we get from it. But this is a first for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Madam Chair, trying to recognize and get into the workforce of people with disabilities, and that's this is a kind of a little supplemental additive to that workforce area. So would this help helps those with severely disabled get into the workforce?
And are there any questions on the bill? All right, Senator Metzen, would you like to move Senate File Number 975 forward? As amended, have you gone over the amendment yet in Section 7 that did go over that with the new language?
I thought we talked about that.
We did, okay. So we talked about the amendment.
Senator Shide, did you have, was there something on this bill? Okay. I guess we're ready. I'm ready.
Okay. Are we ready? Senator Bach?
Senator, before Senator Tomasoni left, he said he'd like to see this in finance. I wasn't here for the discussion, so I don't know why, but finance division of this committee, so.
Well, it doesn't go to the division, but it would go to.
It would go to finance?
Roll it into the omnibus bill.
What omnibus bill?
Here, economic development jobs bill in the House.
I guess I, maybe that's the parochial vote or something. Maybe that's what you're doing, but.
So then
I don't see
perhaps we can ask Senator Tomasoni. Would you like to see this bill in your finance division, Senator?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, I think this changes the way the money is being appropriated for these projects because right now it's 100% of it goes to rural.
Would you word around, Senator, for the explanation what's going on? The whole state pays for this program.
Right, and right now we're
changing. And if you want to put an amendment on where it's the money collected in the cities is separate, stays here in the rural, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, I'm not saying I'm going to kill it in my committee. I just want to take a look
well,
at
it. Well, you can't.
You
shouldn't kill it, Madam Chair.
Well,
a non
since it's changing the funding, though, I think it should go to my committee.
Maybe we should delay this bill. And
all right. We'll, why don't you make it that we'll lay it on the table and
yeah.
We'll come back to it, do some work on it. Okay. Senator Anderson is here with Senate File 817. Welcome, Senator Anderson.
Thank you
very
much.
You are here with Nurses Overtime Regulation Compliance Requirements.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill will look familiar to you because this committee, well, the different version of this committee passed this bill last year, and for a variety of reasons it wasn't able to pass all the way through. But we're back, and we'd like to pass it. And this is a follow-up on a law that I passed with the help of the legislature in 2002, which prohibited employers of nurses from requiring them to work mandatory overtime shifts if the nurse in her or his professional judgment believed that it could impair their ability to provide patient care in a safe and adequate manner. The bill passed in 2002, was signed into law. It's been very successful. The bill that we passed earlier covers some state employees, but we realized that it doesn't cover all state nurses. And so we're trying to correct that oversight in the bill now to make sure that it's a comprehensive policy. And we certainly believe that when the state is the employer, we should provide the same level of protection for patients and for nurses that that we require private employers to do of the nurses in our state. And so what we would do, I have an amendment which kind of moves things around just a tiny bit, but it has the same basic impact. So maybe, Madam Chair, I should put the amendment on first.
That would be a good idea.
It.
We're going to pass that out. It is an author's amendment.
I'd move that amendment, Madam Chair.
I have, Madam Chair, I have to make an oral change to the amendment, though, that Mr. Fuller has suggested.
All right. We're looking at the A1 amendment. Would you like to make an oral change to the amendment?
And we want to thank Mr. Fuller, who caught a drafting error, just to make it clear that it does what it's supposed to do. On the A1 amendment, I'll wait till everyone, does everyone have that? On line 1.2 of the amendment, after insert, with respect to nurses described in section 181.275, subdivision 2A.
So could you repeat that again, Senator Anderson?
Insert, before subdivision A, or excuse me, where it says on line 1.2, before subdivision 2A, insert the words, with respect to nurses described in section 181.275.
Subdivision 2A. Does everyone have that?
Yeah.
All right. All those in favor of it, we'll just incorporate it. We have incorporated that into the A1 amendment, and all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign, and amendment A1 passes.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then let me explain how the bill would now work. We are in section 1 is still in the bill, and what that does is references the new subdivision 2A, which describes state-employed nurses, and makes clear that the Department of Labor and Industry can enforce the law as to state nurses. So the state agencies that would employ nurses would be subject to this law. And then in the amendment, we delete sections 3 and 4, which are basically restating current law, and a repealer, which I'll explain in a moment. So essentially what we're doing is creating a new section, subdivision 2A, that define state nurses as nurses who are employed by the state of Minnesota and include them under the existing law that prohibits the required mandatory overtime. And then the last piece, the repealer, we were going to try to repeal the – there's no penalty in the current law, and we just are leaving that as is. So we're not changing that with the amendment. And briefly, what I want to say in support of the bill is that – when I worked on this bill in 2002, it was really an eye-opening experience for me to hear from nurses all over the state who talked about the difficulty of their jobs and the fact that they're really torn between their job responsibilities and their responsibilities to do what they're to fill in whenever employers tell them to work double shifts and their own personal code of ethics. They literally have a code of ethics like lawyers have to meet and other professionals that requires them to provide the very best patient care. And sometimes when they've worked a 12-hour shift already and are ordered to do another full shift or an 8-hour shift in order to do another full shift, they believe that they can't do so adequately if they're too tired. And with all the press and concern we've heard lately about the Veterans Home in particular, I think we all understand what that can mean, not just for the nurses, but for the patients. And so we want to make sure that our nurses are treated fairly and have the opportunity to make those professional decisions in a way that protects patient safety. That's exactly what this bill will do. And I have with me Mary Jo George from the Minnesota Nurses Association and Judy Goldberg, who is an RN at the Vets Home, and they'd like to say a few words.
And to Ms. George.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We represent over 20,000 registered nurses statewide, including 750 registered nurses that work in state service, including such facilities as our regional treatment centers, corrections, and, of course, at our veterans home. And as Senator Ellen Anderson said, Judy Goldberg is joining me today. We'd like to thank Senator Anderson for bringing this bill forward again this year and the opportunity to testify. Again, what this bill is doing is simply allowing a nurse in her or his judgment to refuse overtime if they feel unsafe. We are not prohibiting mandatory overtime altogether by the employer to use that. This is amending current law, which is working fine within our private sector and in some of our hospital facilities. Again, as Senator Ellen Anderson alluded to, over the past few years, we've been having Department of Health surveys at the veterans' home show violations in care. And we have been saying for the past few years that we believe it's a direct result of a nurse staffing crisis and the overuse of mandatory overtime. When we don't have enough staff, employers tend to use overtime as a normal, regular staffing tool. And we think what's happening is the use of overtime is pushing nurses beyond their capacity to make good judgments and to provide appropriate quality care to patients. Some of our nurses are being asked to work 16-hour shifts twice, sometimes as much as twice a week. And unfortunately, they're being disciplined when they say no. So what the bill does is actually take away the disciplinary approach that employers could use. One of the things that the mandating people beyond 12 hours is not recognizing is growing research that we have on fatigue, which shows there is exponential increase in medical errors after the first 12 hours of work, not to mention 16 hours. Requiring mandatory overtime is also making it difficult for us to retain quality staff. In 2005, we had over 27 nurses leave the Minneapolis Veterans Home, and we continue to see them leaving. We know there are other options that employers can use, and we know that they are working. So we really encourage you to pass this bill. And I'd like to pass it over to Judy to have her speak from a personal experience.
Thank you, Ms. Goldberg, for being here today.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Judy Goldberg. I'm an RN, and I've worked at the I've worked at the state or for the state of Minnesota for 19 years, the past 6.5 at the Veterans Home on the evening shift, which is the 3 to 11 p.m. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my experiences and concerns relating to mandatory overtime. I have a lot of seniority in the state system, yet I have been mandated to work 8 hours past my 8-hour shift on several occasions. Recently, I was working 3 to 11 with a pool nurse and a new LPN. The pool nurse can and did refuse to stay for the night shift. Both the LPN and I were mandated that night. Not only did I feel unsafe to work overtime since I'd been up early that morning for an appointment, but now I had to orient the LPN to this night shift, which is not my usual shift. I had asked the supervisor to try to find someone to come in early for the morning shift, and was told, no one will come anyway. Luckily, that night, I almost made a med error, but caught it in time. The press has recently focused on medication errors and their impact on lives and financial costs. The chance of these errors happening increases dramatically when nurses are mandated to work when they are tired and unable to think or reason effectively. This has been acknowledged by the legislation in Minnesota for hospital nurses, but state nurses have been excluded. Most of the time, we deal with medically challenged people. Our patients have multiple diagnoses, diabetics, heart disease, kidney failure, respiratory problems, and with the dementia, we have a lot more behavior problems. These people also receive multiple medications. Some of them get up to 40 to 50 medicines in one day. As a nurse, I have to be aware of the side effects of these drugs, their interactions with each other. In addition, consider the foods they have eaten and their hydration status. Add to that a fall or another emergency situation when the nurse is already exhausted and you can see the safety issues. Although mandatory overtime is inevitable in emergency situations, it has been grossly misused in the state system to compensate for understaffing and the refusal to consider on-call positions. At MVH, as well as other state facilities, we are subject to reprimands when we refuse mandation, even when we feel unsafe to work or due to family obligations such as lack of child care. The letter of reprimand used at the vet's home is both degrading and intimidating. at the vet's home, we've lost several experienced nurses in the past 3 to 4 years. Some of them had worked there for 10 to 20 years. These were valuable, dedicated employees. The main reason they left is the increase in mandatory overtime and the consequences threatened if they refuse. I also know of an experienced nurse who had applied for a position and at her interview was informed that she would be required to do mandatory overtime as part of her job. She chose not to take the job rather than subjecting herself to mandation. To sum it all up, my first concern is the safety of my patients. They are all veterans who have served this great country or their spouses. They have entrusted me with their well-being and their health. Secondly, I'm concerned for my RN license, which I am very proud and have worked hard for the last 39 years to maintain. Lastly, I am concerned for my health and the health of my fellow nurses who are forced to do overtime. It is draining physically, mentally, and emotionally. Thank you for your attention to this vital nursing issue, and I hope you pass this.
Thank you very much, Ms. Goldberg. This committee has not had testimony on this particular issue, and so hearing your perspective is very helpful for us just as we read the newspapers and hear about the issues that are going on at the vet's home. And I want to thank you for your service, to our veterans as well and bringing this to our attention. Are there any questions, Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, thank you for bringing this forward, especially in light of what we've been reading about that's happening. And we know that we're going to be called on even further with our veterans coming home. And so we want our veterans hospital to be functioning at the highest possible level of quality and service that we can in the coming year and in the coming years. So I appreciate this bill. One of the concerns I have is, let's say we pass this law, the things that you're talking about really have to do with a culture. And, you know, a law does not change a culture. And so I'm concerned that if we just pass this law and then say, well, that won't happen anymore, that we'll be missing what's really happening. And so I don't have the answer, but I would like to raise a concern that I think there might be more work needed here than just passing a law, that with the passing of the law that there ought to be conversations and we ought to look at how we can impact that particular culture.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, thank you. We absolutely recognize that there are a multitude of issues that we have to address at the vet's home. I think by passing this law, though, I think one of the things that we'll do is create some balance in terms of negotiating with the employer. We have not been successful in getting this language in contract language for many years, and it will provide some balance, and I think what it will do is help us create some opportunities, we hope, for discussion with management about new ways to look at how we can fill the shifts. And obviously, we're working with them to try to get more funding for nurse staffing as well, but we'd like it to be a collaborative approach.
Good.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonoff brings up a very good point, and I don't think anybody on this committee sits on the health budget, but we had the hearing from the Minneapolis Veterans Home on Friday, mm-hmm. 2.5 hours of hard grilling about this very issue. And I guess my question is to you, Ms. George, and you did somewhat address that, mm-hmm. is this a when you look at the veterans home issue, there's 5 locations, and this is the only one in the metro. So it really, after 2.5 hours of grilling these people, it really came down to that in Minneapolis, they can't necessarily provide the hourly wage that they can out in greater Minnesota. Those jobs in greater Minnesota are very good jobs, and they hold on to them very long time. You have high turnover at the veterans home in Minneapolis. So is this strictly about bargaining power for...
Madam Chair, George. Senator Rosen, we actually think that the state service has some very good benefits, and it's not all about wages. I think if you talk to nurses, oftentimes they will say they will leave not because of the money but because of the working conditions. And so many of our nurses, it has been why the wages aren't completely comparable to hospital care. It's fairly comparable to private long-term care facilities. And with the pensions and benefits, we think that there you know, there's motivations for nurses to stay there. And they want to provide the good care, but I think what happens is in the environment that they're working, they feel unsafe and at risk for their license. So we don't think this is just about money and just about bargaining, but we do have to create a safe work environment, both for the nurses and the patients. With regard to the staffing money that was appropriated last year, we had stipulated to get some language in the bill that asked the Veterans Home Board to negotiate with the unions at the Veterans Home Board. That unfortunately didn't happen, but we were very concerned with their proposal because we felt that it wasn't recognizing what the role of the RN is in providing care. We felt that maybe they were moving to hire too many nurses aides and not enough RNs for the acuity of the patients out at the veterans home. So we still are working with them to, you know, create staff matrices that we think will work. We believe that we have lost 9 key positions, what are called charge nurses, that we've been asking them to consider reinstating. So it's a number of issues, but I think we do need to work together on it, and we hope we can provide, you know, solutions. But we think we can keep our nurses there if we can improve the work environment. So I hope I answered your question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Ms. George, you did. And there it is a complexity of problems mm-hmm. at that one home. Absolutely. And it's not to say one bill is going to solve all. It has to be a combination of your association mm-hmm. and the whole business environment. And it needs a lot of work.
Absolutely. Are there any other questions? I believe that Mr. Larson is here as well and would like to testify from the Department of Employee Relations.
Yeah. Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Employee Relations. In that capacity, I also serve as the state labor negotiator, and I'm responsible for overseeing the collective bargaining with the state employee labor unions throughout the executive branch. I've been in the Department of Employee Relations, and I've held a variety of labor relations positions for the last 20 years. And I've heard the testimony from the Minnesota Nurses Association regarding this bill, and while we all have certain feelings with regard to being forced to work overtime, one of the phenomenons that we have in the occupations in a lot of our state jobs, which are 24/7 facilities, require coverage on all three shifts, regardless of whether or not we have the staff available. The assignment of work for employees is a term and condition of employment for which we negotiate in our labor agreements. I've been involved in negotiating the nurses' agreement off and on for probably the last 20 years, and I have worked steadfast with this organization in trying to address the issue of overtime. For example, we have a seniority-based system when they have overtime and they want the overtime, you know, volunteer overtime, for example. And we have also worked an agreement with the nurses' union when no one wants the overtime, and that is a seniority-based system as well. We did address the issue of forced overtime with the nurses' union a couple of rounds ago, and that was is that you could only be forced one time in a pay period. And so we have addressed the issue of overtime with this group, and I think we've done a good job on that. Again, I believe, and I'll echo this throughout my testimony, that we really believe that this does not belong in law, and we don't believe that this belongs for the legislature. I'm a real fan of labor relations and contract bargaining with state employee unions, and I've been doing it for 20 years. You will not see me coming here to this body asking you to provide to me in law things that I was unable to get at the bargaining table. A handshake in this business means something. And I have, I think, bargained in good faith with this organization, and I just do not appreciate the fact that we have to come here and testify against a bill like this. We have, for example, if there was be a chemical spill out here on Highway 94, our pollution control agency specialists are going to be assigned to work that until the spill is cleaned up. Troopers that come across serious fatalities in the highway are going to stay there. And that's just the point that we understand when you're in those occupations. With regard to the negotiations of this, is we've had proposals in the past from the union that said that they just don't have to work it. Well, what are we going to do? We still have our patients. We can't tell our veterans that we're not going to provide this service. So we're going to have to do it. If they refuse to work overtime, we're going to have to do it. And by the way, in the Labor Relations Bureau at the Department of Employee Relations, I have yet in my office to see any disciplinary action of a nurse that the union has asked to appeal and go to hearing on in this matter. Now, there may have been something at the local agency level, but it has never come to the Department of Employee Relations for arbitration. The union brought this matter up has brought it up in negotiations, and like I said, we have tried to address this issue, and I think we've done a good job in doing it. But the point ends up being is that there will be instances where this is going to happen. I would like to share with you that about three rounds ago, we went to interest arbitration on a variety of issues that the nurses had in collective bargaining with the interest arbitrator, who is well-versed in the area of labor relations. And the arbitrator ruled in favor of the employer, because here was, again, what the union was seeking to receive from the arbitrator. The arbitrator ruled that mandatory overtime is a critical and defining feature of the party's employment relationship. It is the linchpin of their staffing policies, and as such, to disturb it could result in unintended consequences. And the arbitrator left it up to the parties to continue to bargain over, in which we have. And then lastly, while the association has maintained that this puts them on an even keel with the rest of the nurses that we have in the state system work in the health department, they work at the veterans' homes, they work at the Department of Corrections, they work for the Department of Human Services. And we do not consider these facilities as hospitals per se. And I guess I'd ask you, if you would, Madam Chair and members of these committees, if you'd look at page 2 of this legislation and look at lines 17 through 19. When this legislation was passed 3 or 4 years ago, which did, as I said, there was an exception to that, and it said this subdivision does not apply to nursing facility, an intermediate care facility for persons with developmental disabilities, a licensed board and care facility, or a housing with service establishment. The reason being is that just our staffing levels are as such, we just don't have the luxury of a hospital when it comes to staffing. And what this legislation is doing is saying, but if it's not the state, it applies. But if it does apply to the state, all of those nursing homes, health care facilities, and so on, applies to. And I guess I question the wisdom that when this legislation originally passed, why the legislature exempted those. But during this now session, the legislature is saying, we'll exempt those for the non-state employees, but we're going to put the nurses for the state and make it apply to them. It's just simply unfair, and I think it creates a staffing burden and a consequence to us as an organization that we do not deserve. Thank you.
Other questions? You know, I think there's a difference between some of the examples that you gave, that when there's a chemical spill or a state trooper, is that there are emergencies that come up, but I think that we know that when we have our veterans in a home or we have other sorts of care facilities like this, it's an ongoing basis, and the real crisis is that we don't have enough staff. Is that the, you know, the source of the problem, that we don't have enough nurses to fill these particular shifts?
Madam Chair, it varies. Yes, I would say that, well, first of all, I think it's important to note that the statistic that you gave you on the turnover was in 2005. It's 2007. That was 2 years ago. I haven't had a chance to look at that turnover, but typically when we look at turnover, we like to look at turnover in a sense of, did people actually leave because we weren't paying enough or working conditions? It's not uncommon when you look at, when you just request turnover, it includes promotions, It includes retirements, includes debt. I'm not accusing the union of doing that, but I'm a little suspect of that number. I'm going to go back and take a look at that turnover number. What we have in our collective bargaining agreement, Madam Chair, we have over 40 leave provisions in this collective bargaining agreement for which employees can call in and take leave. They can take vacation leave. They can take sick leave. There's a variety of leaves, and certain leaves you have to do, and sick leave is one of them. And we are at a staffing level, typically, Madam Chair, where most of our facilities are operating on a flat level. If we need 10 employees, that's what we have. If we have 13 employees, we allow three of them to use vacation, and we operate on the minimum staffing level they have. If someone calls in sick, guess what happens? Someone has to stay. And that's the consequence of that. Now, once in a while, we'll keep an extra person over. But then, you know, once we're denying a vacation, so it's a delicate balance. We have, I think, that our staffing concerns are no different than any other healthcare facility right now. And then I also think it's important that one other point, Madam Chair, and that the money that the legislature appropriated for additional funding for the veterans' homes has been spent and has been spent over. After this hearing, by the way, I'm going to the next legislative hearing because the nurses' contract is up for its ratification. And I'm speaking in favor of that because it was something that I negotiated with them, we negotiated with them, and I supported. But their money for staffing and all of that is represented in the costs associated with that agreement. So I believe that the current staffing level, assuming that we can manage it, that we're doing the best we can.
And Senator Bonoff, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment for the commissioner. The fact that we have in statute recognize that nurses are in a somewhat different position because patient safety is at stake. And so because of that recognition, we have in statute that if, in their judgment, working overtime would harm patient safety, and that is something that has been publicly recognized by law, that that condition can happen. And now we've seen instances where things haven't been going well in some of these facilities. It seems to me that it's time to conform this type of facility with the rest of the law. And the fact that we are singling out the state, I agree with you. I don't think we ought to be. I think that if we think that this is important, that we ought to make that even more broadly so that there is conformity. I don't ever believe that it's our role to intervene in the bargaining process, and so I'm not here to intervene in that. I'm more here to say that if patient safety is, as stated in law, the primary interest, then we ought not to let our concerns about how many people we have working in one place or another dictate this very important policy. So it's for that that I'm supporting it and not to intervene in your ability to bargain.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I could just make a comment as well. I appreciate what you said, Senator Bonoff. You know, I don't think it's productive to argue about the collective bargaining process and who's right and who's wrong about that. I think we should just remember that we passed this law in 2002, and it's worked, and it's been successful. And if the private sector can do it, I'm not sure why the state of Minnesota would find it too burdensome if private hospitals can manage to comply with it. We know that basic workplace safety standards are something that belongs in the purview of state laws, and it's our responsibility of legislators, as legislators and as Congress, to look at that. That's why we have laws that, under federal law, that limit airline pilots to how many hours they can fly, because it's a matter of grave public safety and concern to the public. We do the same thing with locomotive engineers. I don't know what the other examples are, but I'm sure there are others. I want to clarify also, this doesn't prohibit the use of mandatory overtime. What it does is first of all, there is an exception for emergencies, and so the examples that Mr. Larson gave certainly sound like emergency situations, and the law very explicitly allows this to be used as a tool by employers, by the operators of the facility in an emergency. It can a nurse can be offered an overtime shift, and oftentimes will take it, but there's lots of other ways, as Senator Bonoff said, of changing the culture of how scheduling and management deals with shifts to proactively prevent this from being a problem. And that's what we want to see happen. So, members, I would urge you to support the bill and remind you that the Senate passed this bill last year in virtually a similar bill.
Senator Neville has a question.
Madam Chair, I don't know too much about the nursing in public versus private sectors, but I seem to recall that in the private sector there are nursing pools, so that if a particular hospital is short, they can tap into the pool. Is the state permitted to do that? I mean, it strikes me that on the state level, we can't hire private sector people to come in and do the public sector jobs. Don't the contracts prohibit that? Or do we have access to those nursing pools?
And Mr. Larson?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, we have, in the fact, utilized pool nurses where we have, in particular, needed them. Yes, we have. Yes.
All right.
All right. Are there other questions or testimony?
Madam Chair, I guess the final thing I'd say, and that is that I was not following this legislation when this was 3 or 4 years ago, but I question why the legislature exempted the nursing facilities under lines 27 through 19, and I'm still not convinced through the testimony why the legislature believes that the state, that it has to apply to those facilities when the legislature specifically exempted the other ones. And I would ask that if you exempted the other ones back then our facilities that fall under those licensing standards should also be exempted.
Madam Chair, I believe that there's a rule under Minnesota rules that cover those facilities. So that's why we exempted them.
Okay. Is there other discussion? All right. Would someone like to move forward? Senate file 817.
Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
I'm confused by Senator Anderson's last comment.
I'm trying to, Madam.
Why would a rule take precedence over the statute? I mean,
well, Madam Chair, there was already a rule that dealt with I believe it dealt specifically with the issue of mandatory overtime in these facilities. So we just let that govern the situation.
But there was still a policy decision that we could have accepted it or not in statute.
We could have. It just seemed like a simpler way to deal with it. This is 5 years ago, so I'm not remembering the details discussion beyond that.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson,
Neville.
Since we have made that policy decision with respect to nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities, et cetera, why not do that in the public sector just like the private sector?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, there's not a rule that covers the state agencies and the Veterans Home and the Corrections Department. So we need to do this for them to be covered by
Well, except,
by
Madam
a minimum
Chair,
standard.
You're arguing that the rest of the statute works in the private sector and that the public sector should be treated the same way.
The rule.
Why shouldn't it with respect to the exceptions as well?
Senator Anderson?
Madam Chair, honestly, I haven't looked at this rule in 5 years, so I can't tell you whether it covers – I assume it just – I don't know whether it covers public and private. Can you help me with this?
So, Ms. George, would you like to comment on this?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville – when we came forward with the legislation 5 years ago, we did decide to opt out the private nursing homes because they do have a rule on the books that we all believe is working fairly well. It's more stringent than, for example, our contract language that we have for state nurses. So we're not seeing the problem. So we didn't think they had asked if they could be exempt from the law. And when we looked at the rule, we thought it was just fine. If at some point you want to make an amendment to add them back in, we probably wouldn't oppose that. But at this point, we believe that the rule is working fine in terms of not seeing abuses of mandatory overtime. Does that answer the question?
No.
Follow-up
okay.
question, Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
I'm Ms. George. I'm still confused. What is the rule with regard to them? Are they allowed to oppose mandatory overtime if they have a problem? I can't tell by your answer.
Ms. George.
Madam Chair, I don't have the reference of the rule either, but I believe that they put limits on to how long they can. They can mandate as well, but they have restrictions in terms of what overtime or what an emergency is. So we're not seeing them use it as a regular staffing tool. But we, again, what I could do is try to get a copy of the reference to it to
Madam
show the
Chair
committee.
And Ms. George and Senator Anderson, it sounded to me like what you were saying was that they actually dealt with the problem and made a rule that everybody was comfortable with. It's not that they are living with the same rule that we're opposing. They actually have, in their opinion, fixed the problem.
Yeah. Madam Chair, exactly. That's I thought I had said that, and I'm sorry if that wasn't understood correctly. They've already dealt with the problem. They don't permit. They have the same general types of restrictions that we are asking for in this bill and that the law does in the other sectors.
Okay. We have Mr. Larson and then Barbara Cox from the Department of Corrections would like to testify as well. So, Madam Mr. Larson, if you'd like to make a comment,
Ms.
Cox.
We are, though we do have licensed intermediate care facilities, health board facilities and stuff. We are aware of those rules. We can live under those rules. And so it would seem to me that by exempting what's the rules that have been established for those are rules that we can live under. And what you're doing here is you're carving that out and saying that for the state it doesn't apply. We can live under those rules. Thank you.
Okay. We have Barbara Cox here to testify on behalf of the Corrections Department. Welcome, Ms. Cox.
Actually, Madam Chair, I'm Nanette Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services. Sorry.
Welcome, Ms. Larson.
Thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to point out a couple of issues with respect to the emergency language because that may not work real well for the Department of Corrections. First and foremost, I want to tell you that we very much appreciate the hard work that our nursing staff do. For those of you who have our correctional facilities in your districts or have visited our correctional facilities, you know what kind of population we deal with, how litigious they are. We also understand that assigning nurses to work overtime is an undesirable action, and we do it as a very last resort. But we can't utilize community resources as an option for providing nursing care to our offender population. For those of you who know our facilities, at our facility at Oak Park Heights, we have a transitional care unit. It's a 48-bed unit where we provide pre- and post-surgical care. We provide hospice care. We don't want to have to take those guys off-site to a community hospital or a nursing home. We want to have them in our facility and providing care to them. To the extent that we don't have nursing staff available to us, that would be something that we would have to do at a much greater cost to the state and jeopardizing public safety as well. So the emergency language that's in this bill talking about terroristic acts, disease outbreaks, adverse weather conditions, it's not a real workable provision for us. We need to have a certain level of staffing at all of our facilities. We have a constitutional obligation to provide care to our offenders, and as such, we would need to overstaff in order to ensure that we can provide the care. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there other testimony or questions? All right. Would someone like to move forward Senate File 817 as amended?
Madam Chair, I'll move it.
To Senator Tomasoni.
I'll move it.
We'll move it forward. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Same
no.
sign?
No.
And Senate File number 817 passes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And
go
this,
to the floor.
We understand, will go straight to the floor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
To committee members.
All right. Our next bill is Senate File 879, Senator Metzen, Packing House Workers Bill of Rights, Meatpacking Workers Ombudsman. And we have several people here to testify with Senator Metzen. Welcome back, Senator Metzen.
I think it's welcome back.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Today.
I think, Madam Chair, we're probably going to lay this one over, I think, because there's some things that I think have to be worked on. But I really want to bring this very important Packing House Workers' Bill of Rights to the attention of all the committee members and try to get a good full-blown discussion on the problems that are out there. there's a couple of sections to the bill. Section 1... an employer must provide its employees with, and you can listen to these, and I don't think it's asking too much, adequate working restroom facilities, adequate room for meal and rest breaks, adequate locker facilities, adequate time for necessary restroom breaks. And it goes on to talk about the equipment must be adequate to perform the tasks of the jobs. And then we talk about the information provided to employees by the employer. Again, we don't think we're asking for too much. It's a complete description of the salary and benefit plans that they provide, a job description of the employee's position, a description of leave policies. And there are a couple of more that you could probably read for yourself. And again, I think these are just the right things to do for employees that work in this very tough industry. And I'm very familiar with the packing house industry. I worked at Armour's. I was a member of Local 4. Worked there for 4 years while I was going to college. At South St. Paul was a huge meat packing business back in the turn of the century on to about 1970 or so when Swift and Armour's moved out, taking with them 7,800 union employees. And our town was devastated. We're still fighting back 25, 30 years later. We have one meatpacking plant left in our community. And again, we didn't rebuild overnight, but that, I guess that's really my interest in this bill, because I look back and see some of the conditions that we all had to work under, and I'm sure it's improved a lot, and I know it has, but there are still problems out there, and the things I mentioned I don't think are too onerous or too tough for the employers to deliver. Section 2, to make sure that these things I just mentioned are carried out, we do spend a few bucks. We have an ombudsman that'll work for the Department of Labor and Industry. That'll go out and his or her job will be to look at these facilities and make sure that adequate conditions are met out there. And so there will be a small finance proponent of this legislation, but a small price to pay for these, make sure that these conditions of these men and women are adequate to workplace. So with me, my first guest is Mr. Bernie Hess. Bernie's with the union down our way, and he would like to visit with the committee for a few minutes, and we have another distinguished presenter too. So
thank you, Mr. Hess, for being here and helping us to understand this issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Bernie Hess, I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 789. We'd ask your support for Senate File 879. This is a broad-based campaign with labor, faith, and immigrant rights coalition seeking your support. We feel that by establishing this position, it will provide an oversight needed to ensure that employers are providing proper equipment and proper information, explaining the rights and protection developed under the various laws. In addition, this bill would provide a very necessary and justified legal recourse for aggrieved employees to pursue if necessary. I'll just give you a real quick background. Meatpacking is a very dangerous job in the U.S. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 12.6 injuries per 100 workers in meatpacking. This compares to 6.3 injuries per 100 workers in other manufacturing facilities. Many of the workers in these plants, as you know, are the newly arrived, and many workers are unaware of their rights under OSHA or Workers' Comp, Fair Labor Standards Act, and to name a few of the statutes. Certainly, as a state that has prided itself on worker safety over the years, we can do better by moving this legislation along. The industry continues to grow in Minnesota with close to 320 meatpacking plants in the state. It's got over 16,000 workers in meatpacking. We recognize the economic impact on a number of communities, and we want to be very clear to those that are here from the industry today. We applaud good training and good policies. We just want to push that along. And also, as a side benefit, and I'll close, we feel that by passing this legislation, we will also increase food safety for our consumers, and that should be an utmost concern for us here So Local 789, Local 1161, Local 9, Local 6 are, along with their coalition partners, Jewish Community Action, Workers Interfaith Network, and the Midwest Coalition for Human Rights, ask your support for this bill. Thank you. And at this time, I'll hand off to the rabbi.
Thank you. And Rabbi Morris, thank you for joining us today, helping us understand this
thank
issue
you,
as
Madam
well.
Chairman. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Rabbi Morris Allen from Beth Jacob Congregation in Mendota Heights. And it's an honor to be sitting next to my state senator, Senator Metzen. We live in our district, in our senatorial district. We have not only South St. Paul, we have Mendota Heights. And there may be some economic disparity between those two communities. But there never should be legislation, or the lack of legislation, which creates a disparity in terms of human dignity. And the dignity of the people who work in South St. Paul should be no less and no less of a concern than the dignity of the people who live in Mendota Heights. I'm here today not only as a congregational rabbi in Mendota Heights, but I'm also the chair of a national commission that was formed by the Rabbinical Assembly, which is the body of rabbis affiliated with the conservative movement, and the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, which is our synagogue organization of congregations, that is charged to address the whole issue of kashrut, of the laws of eating, or fulfilling the laws of our dietary laws which we are obligated to fulfill. I have spent the better part of my 21 years in the rabbinate promoting the importance of kashrut. And I should say, you know, in some ways, hearing from a congregational clergy on a political matter, you might say, what's that all about? What would a congregational clergy know about politics after 21 years in the same pulpit? Let me just assure you, let me explain why this is a concern. When I promote the importance of our dietary laws, I do so because the word kosher means fit, that the animal itself must be kosher. It must be fit. We make sure in our promotion of the laws of kashrut that the animals, that there are kosher animals and there are non-kosher animals, that the means by which that animal is slaughtered must be done in a kosher manner. There is a means by which that animal, the concern for that animal is such that it has to be slaughtered in a manner that is consistent with the laws of the Jewish people. And we are concerned about the animal at that very moment, which who will provide us with food. And that the means by which that animal must be produced, the meat from which that that will be produced from that animal, must be done in a kosher manner. It also must be kosher. And this year, after an article appeared about a major meatpacking plant, the largest meatpacking plant that is not in the state of Minnesota, but is in a neighboring state, our neighboring state and good neighbor of Iowa, was producing meat and in largest meatpacking producing plant for kosher food. Perhaps 65 to 70% of all kosher food in America is produced in that plant. When an article appeared in the Forwards in May of 2006, which questioned some of the means by which the workers were treated, I rallied, after 20 years of promoting the eating of kosher food, a national committee, and was able to put together a national committee to investigate whether or not the charges were correct and to understand what indeed was our responsibility as Jews, not only to the animals that must be produced in a kosher manner, but also to the workers who are the means by which that food is produced. And if we are more concerned in the Jewish community about how an animal itself is treated and how the concern and the care that is taken in the approaching an animal for slaughter. And I must tell you that it is truly a moving act to watch a shochet, a ritual slaughter, approach an animal before slaughter. But it should be equally important for us to be concerned about the worker who has to hoist that animal after it has been slaughtered. It has to be an equal concern about the worker on the line who must produce that meat after it has been slaughtered. We have to be concerned that while we are so preoccupied with whether or not the lung of that animal is smooth or not smooth, which constitutes two different forms of kosher meat, that we are less concerned about the bladder of the worker in terms of whether or not he or she is able to find the time to go to the bathroom. That there is something wrong in a society And certainly, this is the issue that I have addressed in my own religious community, where we are more concerned about the rights, and there are rights for those animals, and the concern and the care that we have to demonstrate for those animals, but when we don't demonstrate that same concern for the workers who must produce it. Let me tell you what we witnessed when we went into those meatpacking plants. What we saw was in two meatpacking plants that there was not always human resources staff available who spoke the language of the majority of workers in those plants. Imagine if you're newly arrived from the mountain country of Guatemala and working in a meatpacking plant and you have a concern about something and you're not sure whether or not you understand exactly who to go to and how to approach. We watched training take place in which training was done in English for workers who clearly were not only inarticulate and maybe not even and were maybe illiterate in English, but who may have been at a very rudimentary level in their own Spanish as well. That this what this Meatpacking Bill of Rights bill does is to ensure that the kind of training that will take place in the vernacular, ensuring that the workers who produce the meat that we are privileged to eat will be able to understand not only the safety concerns, but what to do in case there is an accident that occurs. I could go on at length to talk about how this bill would be far-reaching and would make a statement about the goodness of the state of Minnesota. Only one other state, my home state of Nebraska, has such a bill. I really believe that in the state of Minnesota, we should be at the same level or beyond what Nebraska is capable of doing as it comes to the treatment of our own workers in meatpacking plants. Let me just conclude with a story which will indicate that I'm not here as labor, I'm not here as management, I'm here in sales. That ultimately we met with many workers at these meatpacking plants. We saw signs of inadequate safety equipment. We saw means by which meatpacking plants were charging workers for the frocks that they were forced to wear. We saw situations that did not speak to the dignity of the people who are doing the work. But perhaps the most telling example of all of this was that we met with a young man from a meatpacking plant in Pennsylvania, a kosher meatpacking plant that happens to be a union plant. And this young man was brought to us by the union people to talk about the difference between a union plant and a non-union plant. And I can assure you that there may indeed be some differences that are in collective bargaining, and the right to collective bargaining should be protected in terms of employees want to so organize. But this young man, I introduced myself and my commission that was with me. There were five of us from across the country sitting with him, and I said, I'm a rabbi and another rabbi here and some committed lay people from the conservative Jewish community across the country. And we're here to find out what it means for you to work in the industry that produces the meat that we are obligated to eat. And Carlos looked at us, and he said, I've worked at this plant for 12 years. Every day I work next to people who are rabbis who are inspecting the food that we are producing. Every day I drive by rabbis as I drive the forklift. Every day we chit-chat. But never once in those 12 years has a rabbi ever asked me what it was like for me to be working in this plant. What that moment said to me was how easy it is for us to sometimes focus in all religions on the ritual acts that we must fulfill, and how easy it is sometimes to forget that at the core of everything that we do in each and every religion and every faith community that we hold on to is to create a more ethical society so that an employee should never feel after 12 years of working side by side by a rabbi that the two of them are not engaged in the very same act. The ethical standards by which the state of Minnesota will be judged in the generations to come are in part the standards that will be passed, I hope, by the Meatpackers' Bill of Rights. Thank you, Madam Chairman, for the opportunity to testify.
Well, Okay, thank you, Rabbi Morris. I think that you've painted a disturbing picture of things that are happening in other states that we, you know, are obviously concerned about, and we want to focus on what's happening here in Minnesota as well, and our work conditions for our employees. Are there any questions for the panel members that are at the table at this time?
Yep, yep. Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
If no one else has anything to say, I will certainly say something about this. And I'm certainly glad, Senator Metzen, that you've decided to lay this over, because I do feel that this is this bill is, number one, Nebraska's Bill of Rights is voluntary. And Nebraska's rate of a work safety record is higher than the national standard. And as a employer, I can honestly say that the most important person in that entire company is the worker. And yes, there are people that are new to the country that work in these plants, and they are very happy to have that job. When you come to this country, you're not automatically going to get a white-collar job. Yes, granted, it is tough labor, and sometimes the conditions aren't that great because you are working in a meatpacking plant. You are dealing with animals and an end product. And these people are very... And I'm just speaking because of our personal business. But I can say that a lot of the people that work in our business have been there for years and are very happy to have the high-quality wage, the insurance that comes along with it, the compensation, the 401K, everything that comes along with this job. Now, it is a little offensive, I will say this bill is, because you're saying that they aren't treated correctly. You're insinuating that they don't have correct bathroom facilities or locker facilities, and how in the world would any employer treat their employee in despicable manner like that? That's just not fair. So what you're saying in this bill is you want somebody to have how many different ethnic groups work in a packing plant, from our company down to Hormel, down to Swift, down to Tyson's, and you have to have a language interpreter for every single one of those languages there? I mean, this bill is truly amazing. You have 16,000 workers, I heard, in this state working in a meatpacking plant. And you have gone down from 45.5 cases in 1991. Let's see what I'm reading this. The statistics say have got the cases have gone down to 45.5 in 91 to 12.6 in 05. And in the slaughtering and processing plants for pork or for poultry, it's gone from 23.1 to 7.4. And you make mention to the manufacturing, other manufacturing is 6.3. What other manufacturing plants have got? I'd like to know what other manufacturing plants are 6.3. I mean, I could go on and on. And as you can tell, Madam Chair, I'm a little emotional about this, but I do feel that this is a bill that perhaps just stretches it way too far. The employee at these meatpacking plants, plain and simple, is the most valued asset they have, and they take very good care of them, not only because of the worker compensation rate, but also because they are a human being, and they work very hard, and they have the right to bargain. They have to have the right to unionize. They have all that. And many of these people are damn glad they have the job.
Very difficult topic, because I think that what we see here is what may be happening somewhere else that is very, very disturbing. And, you know, to that point, I think sometimes it's good for us to have that perspective to see how we're doing things here in Minnesota that are different. And not to say that every meatpacking plant has this situation, but to acknowledge that someone sees something that has, you know, a concern, and to make us aware when we do have an industry in this state. So I think that your comments are well taken, Senator Rosen, to be able to present an alternative to the importance of this industry in our state and how we're doing to, you know, provide good-paying jobs for people as an entry-level job for people who come to this country. So I appreciate that perspective as well. As we all do. Senator Hudson.
I agree with some of what she had to say, but if you're happy to have a job, I'm happy that you have a job. But is it too much to ask for a restroom? Is it too much to ask for a room to have a meal break? Is it too much to ask for a locker facility, even if you're happy to have a job? Is it too much to ask for necessary rest breaks? I mean, we treat some animals better than that. I mean, where they get breaks and they get their food and what. And but I don't think it's asking too much for restrooms and locker facilities and the things we're talking about now. I'm sure Senator Rosen's facilities probably do all of this stuff. What Madam is Chair. The big concern?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Metzen, you also, these meatpacking plants are also under federal guidelines. And there is absolutely no way they are not going to OSHA, the USDA food inspection. Of course, they're going to have bathrooms, and of course, they're going to have facilities for them to take their lunch breaks. This is common sense, and this is not a common sense bill.
Talking about is already in here. What's the concern? I don't understand why so many people are nervous. You do these things. And I think there's some bad guys out there that we're trying to get at. Mm-hmm. And you just stated, it sounds like you're doing these things. Don't worry
Madam
about
Chair,
the bill then.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, I'm not worried about myself. I'm also the precedence that this sets. And also, any packing plant is under federal guidelines. They certainly are going to have the bathrooms. They certainly are going to have the amenities that workers have to have. This is a food industry, and that's well-governed. So on the federal and on the state side, believe
What's
me,
the
that is.
The
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair.
And then Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair, I understand.
Neville.
Senator Rosen. If your business, I mean, I absolutely trust that your business is run probably better, even with higher standards than what are listed in here. I think, though, that what Senator Metzen's got here are the right to have a humane workplace, and I think that some are not. And I, frankly, don't trust the feds to do the kind of inspecting. I think they're more interested in where the people came from and rooting out people undocumented and breaking up families and disrupting an industry, to say nothing of lives. I think they're far more interested in that than regulating safety right now, at least at this time in our country. So I just think if there's any place in Minnesota that doesn't meet these standards, then we need the legislation. That's all I would say. I wouldn't say that everybody out there is violating this. And I didn't see – I think it just mentioned Spanish preferring Spanish as the language, unless you did I did leave and go over to the state office building for about half an hour. But I thought that we were looking for language preference. Okay, that's for the ombudsman, but they're looking for Spanish there.
Yeah.
And I don't know where else it talks about the language,
Chair.
But I think it's
Madam
incredibly
Chair,
important.
Page one, point, line 20.
Incredibly important that people understand their rights, and I'm not sure that I think you're right. I think people are just really grateful and happy to have a job. I wish more of us had that kind of work ethic, but I think it just harkens back to years ago when before we had unions and before there were protections for workers, and I worry that people who don't speak the language and don't understand the culture may be taken advantage of in some situation. And if it's in one situation in the state, it's not acceptable to me. So that's, I don't want to preach at you because I know I'm confident that I could work in you. I could work for you.
Madam Chairman, can I just say one word?
To Rabbi Allen, I think that we have some other people. If we could just maybe respond to Senator Scheid, and then could I take these two
questions?
Please
respond to
Senator Rosen.
Senator Scheid, thank you, Senator Scheid, and I appreciate that. And I will tell you that if anybody around this table has ever been under OSHA guidelines, it is very, very, very tough. And perhaps I am a little sensitive to Rabbi Allen's comments. Our two children have worked in our packing plants, and so I certainly would not put our children in the packing plants where there is some offenses to it. But I think this is an issue that perhaps we're taking too much time on, but as you can see in this room, there's quite a bit of interest in this bill. This is a huge industry in the state, and I think we ought to be very careful and show perhaps a little more respect to the employers and to this industry and how they handle their employees.
All right, Rabbi Allen, did you want to respond to Senator Scheid?
Sure. Thank you. I think there is a great deal of respect for those employers that undertake to meet the dignity of workers. There are, as Senator Scheid said, unfortunately in this state, as we are aware of, and in other states, where there are some employers who unfortunately, not necessarily through malice, but through inattention, are unable to meet the basic dignity of the workers that need to be guaranteed. There are examples in this state and in other states where employees are not able to make it to the restroom in the allotted time for their breaks. There are examples in this state and in other states where in meatpacking plants, between the time that they have to undress and unsuit for lunch and the time that they're able to be back on the line, that their free space does not permit them to have a serious break. I am convinced that Senator Rosen's plant is a decent, caring, well-run, and a model of how human dignity is enhanced. And I think that there's a great deal of respect for those wonderful plants that are in Minnesota. But as Senator Scheid said and Senator Metzen said, were there even one plant in this state that fails to reach that standard, then we in the state of Minnesota must do everything possible to raise the standards so that Senator Rosen's plant and others like it are the models by which the meatpacking industry across this country searches for.
Thank you. Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rabbi. And I was just going to add, I want to talk about Section 2 of the bill for a second, but as a last thought, if there are examples in Minnesota today, well, then let's not sit around the legislature. Please talk to the folks at the Department of Labor and Industry. They're here today. I hope you'll do that, and maybe you already have done that. Moving on. I think this is more for Senator Metzen than his presenters, but I was surprised to see that we're creating this new ombudsman. And then it struck me that's a little bit of a reach here for the president of the Senate, but the ombudsman shall be appointed by the Senate? Have we ever done that before, Madam Chair? President Metzen, I'm looking at Section 2.
I read that today, and I didn't know where that came from. But if you could put the president in the Senate, I'll make the appointment. I bet that's not...
Seems appropriate.
Quite frankly, Mr. Hansen and some others originated this concept, and I didn't see that section till lately. But it's not a big issue with me. I just want the job created, and I don't care who makes the appointment, just so we have a person out there to reel in the bad actors.
And so Madam Chair, having a discussion of the topic. So we're not actually going to vote on the bill today, but it's the points are taken.
And Madam Chair, just as a final point, have this kind of an ombudsman for any other particular specific industry?
I will ask Mr. Fuller if he's aware of that. I'm going to put him on the spot.
Madam Chair, I'm thinking hard. Yeah. Man, there's like crime for an industry. I can't.
Perhaps Mr. Hess has an idea if we have an ombudsman for other areas. Mr. Hess?
Madam Chair and committee, at one time we had an ombudsman for the Department of Corrections. We also had one with nursing homes. And a long, long time ago, and I don't have it at the within reach, but we also had done some stuff with in regards to farm workers in the state, and there was some oversight on that. But I don't have the statute on it.
Madam Chair, if we started the oversight, the ombudsman, and maybe after, 2, 3, 4 years, once they're all caught up and doing the right thing, maybe we could probably at that time
to identify where the problems are. Okay, thank you, Senator Metzen. Senator Neville had a question.
I did. The first witness, I think you said there were about 300 some meatpacking plants. Does that include, Nerstrand Meat Market, where there's two employees, or Odenthal's in Heidelberg? mean, I probably have a half a dozen of these little meatpacking plants, and I'm just wondering what's the definition that this bill would apply to.
Perhaps Mr. Hess.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, this includes everything where they knock down where cattle is slaughtered. So it could be anything from a two-man operation upwards. We're just working off statistics that we got from the state.
Okay, so that 300 does include all the little ones, too.
Madam Chair, so yes, where there's slaughter involved.
Madam Chair, if anybody would like to have a field trip, we can come out to our packing plant and see if kosher kill, and it is a very dignified ceremony, and we can show you the conditions and talk to the people and really see what is happening in the industry.
So I thank you, Senator Manson. You know, perhaps this is an opportunity to acknowledge the businesses in Minnesota that are doing these kind of things yeah. and to recognize, but at some point to also recognize that when these types of rights are not being honored, that we need to recognize that we need to continue to fight for the workers in our state. So I think that we've had a good discussion and are much more educated on this topic. And I thank Senator Rosen for her remarks and also to our testifiers for bringing forward what they feel very passionate about. So thank you so much.
I'm sure that 95% of the packing plants out there are wonderful.
And we want to acknowledge that.
We're not after any of them.
That was not the intent of this, but it was to bring forward an issue. With that, we will adjourn. We will not get to our other bills today, and meeting adjourned.